أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا أبو القاسم محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. First, I want to congratulate everybody, inshallah, on the Eid al-Mab'ath, on a very important day in the history of mankind, an important day in Islam as well. It's a day that changed the world. It's a day that brought Islam into this world. There's nothing more important than this. It's a day that the perfect program for human life was introduced to mankind. And inshallah, for that, I want you to recite three loud salawats. Now also, you're going to have to help me tonight. I've had a long day today, so you're going to have to keep me awake with your salawats, inshallah. Salawat. Now, on this day, what I did, I decided to look at this day and to look at what the Prophet Muhammad, what he gave to us, how he changed humanity, what this message that Allah gave to him did for mankind. And I decided to look in a few different areas. So there's going to be like three or four, maybe even five different areas that we're going to get into one by one. But first, I wanted to, as an introduction, just say that, you know, the Prophet, he came, he gave us the perfect, what's it called, program for living, the perfect path for us to tread upon to get close to Allah. He's the one who showed us how to get close to Allah. He's the one who showed us how to gain proximity with Allah. So the only way, if we want to get close to Allah, we have to go through him. We can't go through any other types of, you know, Chinese medicine or whatever it may be. We only have to go through the Ahlul Bayt, and that's it. And this is what he gave us, and this is something we should take. But also, when we look through, when we want to look at the situation, we see that there's a huge difference between the Arabs before the Prophet came, before the Prophet proclaimed his prophethood, and after Islam was introduced to them. And when we look at this huge difference of this society in just a few years, the Prophet's mission was only 23 years. So this huge difference in this 23-year period, this is when we could recognize how special the Prophet was. This is when we could recognize, you know, how amazing he was and how amazing this message was. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to compare certain aspects of life in the age of ignorance to life after Islam, inshallah. This will be what this speech will be about. Now, I also encourage everybody to try to study a little bit about this age of ignorance. The age of ignorance is that term, that is a term used for the time before Islam in the Arab Peninsula. And when you read about that, you'll see these, you know, how terrible life was at that time and how, you know, amazing it became after Islam. So this is something, it opens our eyes. This is something that we should use. There's one book I would recommend for it. It's a book called The Message. It's written by Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani. It's in English, of course. And it has the first section is a good long section about this period of time. So I'd suggest everyone to read that and to learn that, inshallah. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now the first point that I wanted to touch upon is human value. How do we consider a person better than another? How do we value a human being? Right? What is it that we look for in a human being that separates him from the crowd? Now, in the age of ignorance, they valued human beings by two things. One is by wealth. The second one is by number of children. So the more money you had and the more children you had, the more important you were. The higher your status was in this society, the more people would look up to you. They were the cool people. Everyone wanted to be like them. When you had money and a large amount of children. Now, does Islam agree with this? When Islam came, when Prophet Muhammad came, proclaimed his prophethood, did he agree with this status quo or did he change it? Now, we know that he changed it. And I'm going to read one verse in the Quran in English, inshallah, to show this. In the Quran, what it says. The English translation is this. It is not your wealth nor your children. So you see, Allah is mentioning these two. Why is he mentioning these two? Because that's how, in the age of ignorance, people were valued, by wealth and children. So it says, it's not your wealth nor your children that will bring you close to us in nearness, that will give you this proximity with Allah. That's not what it is. It is those who have faith and act righteously, faith and righteous deeds. It is they for whom will be a twofold reward for what they did. So these people who have faith and righteous deeds will get two times the rewards for everything. And there's other verses that say even more than that. And they will be secure in lofty abodes. So they'll be in heaven, inshallah. So this is the Prophet, of course, being Allah through the Prophet. He's changing this system of how we value mankind. And what does he change it to? He changes it to piety. In the kremukum, in the la atakum, verily the most noblest of you is the most pious of you. Right? So before Islam, it was wealth and children. When Islam came, he changed it to piety. In the lecture that I gave for the Friday prayer today, I talked a little bit about this piety. I want to mention it again, so if you were in the lecture, it's going to be repeated for you, but it's still good to hear it all the time. Piety, what is piety? What is taqwa? We hear it all the time. We're always advised to have it. People always tell us, you have to be pious, you have to be pious, you have to be pious. In the Quran, it's all the time, it's talking about the muttaqin, taqwa, it's all over the place. What is this piety? Now, this is a term that's discussed in great detail in the books of Akhlaq, in books of Irfan, in books of Islamic mysticism, because it's the base of Islamic mysticism. If you don't have taqwa, you won't be able to rise. Taqwa is the base level that everyone has to have. So this is discussed in detail. What do they say taqwa is? Through the different books, through research, it's stated that taqwa is a state that one can have when they sincerely make a decision to perform all of their wajibats and to stay away from all of the muharramat. When one makes this decision, he becomes a muttaqi. When one makes this decision, he is of those people that Allah praises. But the key is keeping that. Because if it's a sincere intention, inshallah, you won't break it within an hour. You have to keep it for as long as possible. And the longer you keep it, the stronger it becomes. The stronger it becomes, the more it protects you from sin. Because as I read in Friday, taqwa is what's it called? Likened to clothing, right? Walabasa taqwa. It's likened to clothing, and clothing is something that protects you from hot and cold weather. So the clothing, this taqwa, protects you from sin, protects you from disobedience. So this is what it is. It's this state of performing all of the wajibats and staying away from all the muharramats. And it's very important. I mentioned a couple stories today. I'm not going to repeat the stories. But this is what taqwa is. And inshallah, we can strive to, inshallah, become these muttaqi. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now, but let's bring this till today. In our Shia communities today, when we look around, which system of valuing or human value is prevalent today? In this masjid or other masjids, in our community, who do the youth look up to? Do they look up to the ones who are the most religious, the most pious? Or do they look up to the rich, the people who have the most wealth? Now, of course, you could be wealthy and pious at the same time. I'm not saying anything about that. Or do they look up to the gangsters, for instance? What is it? If it's that they're looking up to the most religious people, then alhamdulillah, we've kept this. But if the youngsters are looking up to people who, you know, have the fancy cars or who are gangsters or whatever the case may be, then we know that we're falling off the track. We know that we have to change. We have to bring what our prophet brought, and we have to insert it in our community again, because we're losing it. And if we lose what the prophet gave us, we have nothing. All we have is what he gave us. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. I told you, you're going to have to keep me awake here. Louder salawats, inshallah. Now, the second issue that I wanted to discuss is racism. Racism was something that was prevalent in the age of ignorance, where Arabs considered themselves superior to non-Arabs. So, you know, every single non-Arab was nothing compared to an Arab. Then even in the Arabs themselves, the different tribes considered themselves more superior than the other tribes. And the way that they would determine who is the better tribe is the numbers of people in the tribe. So they would count how many people are in each tribe, and the larger tribe is the better tribe. And even if they were equal in numbers, they would count their dead. It's similar to like gangs in Los Angeles. The number that you have is important. So this, they were very racist, these Arabs, before Islam. Now, when Islam came, did Islam reject this racism or did it confirm it? Of course, Islam rejected it. Racism was thrown out the window, that Islam became a religion that was sent for mankind, for everybody. It didn't matter if you were Arab or non-Arab. It didn't matter what tribe you were from. It made no difference. Islam was something for all of humanity, not for Arabs alone. And let me read one verse again in English, where it says, "Laqad karamna bani Adam." Certainly we have honored the children of Adam and carried them over land and sea and provided them with all good things and given them advantage over many of those we have created with a complete preference. So he's saying, first, human beings are the best things that he created. Second, where it says, and certainly we have honored the children of Adam, all of the children of Adam. It doesn't matter if the children of Adam from Ismail, who are the Arabs, or whatever the case may be. All of the children of Adam, all of the races, everywhere throughout the world, they're honored. Being a human being is an honor. It's the best form of creation is the human being. Now, of course, what we do with this honor depends if we soar up to the skies or fall down lower than the animals. But just being a human being is an honor. Just the fact that it doesn't matter what race we are, we could be any race. Just being human being is an important thing. Now, today in our communities, and I've said this before, I'm going to say it again, this community here is an exception. Most of the communities that I've been to, I see racism all over the place. Now, this community, alhamdulillah, it's different. Even today, I went out to lunch with some of the brothers, and I looked around, and we were not even 10 people, but we were from at least 5 different, what's it called, races. In this room right now, we have people from all over the world, right? So this is something special, but this is an exception. So again, this is something we should be happy of. This is something that is something very good here. But it's not the case everywhere. I've been to many different communities throughout the world, and usually what it is the masjid is more of a cultural center than it is a masjid. It's a center where Arabs can speak Arabic, where Iranians could speak Farsi, where Pakistanis can speak Urdu, Khojas could speak Gujarati, or whatever the case may be. And for the converts, we have nowhere to go. But this is usually what it is. This is what I see. Now, a lot of times I'll say, no, you know, everybody's welcome to the masjid. We never close our doors. If anyone who wants to come, they could come. And if we're speaking in Farsi, for instance, we'll have someone translate into English. Or even we'll have an English speech. But the racism is seen not here. It's taken to a further level. Now, there's a lot of brothers who've converted to Islam, and I'm in contact with a lot of them throughout the world. And the major problem that they have is marriage. Marriage is very difficult for them. Not only converts, but for other people as well. And they say that, you know, I'll give you some examples. There's one brother I know in the States. He's Burmese. He converted from Sunniism into Shiaism. And he was looking for a wife forever. He had a good job, he had money, he was religious. There is no reason for someone to turn him down, but no one would accept. And I remember I think he asked every single sister in the community. Yeah, he tried as hard as he could, and no one accepted him. And eventually he ended up marrying a Sunni that didn't wear the hijab, the only person he could find that would marry him. And now, you know, inshallah, he'll come back to the path, but I see he's straying because of this situation. Another brother, an African-American brother, he's a dentist, and he makes a lot of money, very rich person. He comes from a very good family. He's not a convert. His family he was born a Muslim. His family is Muslim, very good people, and he's super religious. Now, there's not many people that are as religious as this brother is. And again, he was looking for marriage. He was looking all over the place. He was asking all kinds of people for marriage. And they would talk to each other. The sister would say, you know, inshallah, you know, I accept. And then her family would say, no, he's African American, you can't marry him. And then they'll tell him, oh, sorry, because you're African American, my family won't accept you. And this happened to him 5, 6, 7. And then he became sore. Now he's like, you know, everyone's racist. Forget these people. I'm not going to the masjid anymore. It happens. You have these people, it's difficult for them. And it's not only for the converts, as I said. For instance, there's a sister I know in the UK. I think she's 27, 28. Her age is getting up there. And she's a Sayyid, and she's Pakistani. And amongst Pakistanis, a Sayyid sister cannot marry a non-Sayyid. It's like a law for them. They think it's not the law of Islam, but they've made it law upon themselves. And so she's been looking for a husband. She can't find a husband that's a Sayyid, that's a Pakistani, that's from her village. And she asked me what she should do. I don't know what she should do, because her family won't accept it. So this is something that you see outside of this community. Alhamdulillah, in this community, I've seen mixed marriages. In this community, there's, you know, a mixture of people here. Everything's in English. But outside of this community, this racism is rampant. It's something that we have to try to curb. It's something we have to try to fight against. Even if we don't have this problem here, our brothers and sisters in other communities do. So inshallah, it's also something, it's something where this was in the age of ignorance. The Prophet came, destroyed it, and again it's crept back into our societies. It's something that we have to again try to fight. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. I know it's been a long program tonight, so inshallah, if you bear with me a few more minutes, then we'll conclude it, inshallah. The next subject I wanted to touch upon was women's rights. Now, women in the age of ignorance were considered property. They weren't considered human beings. Someone would say, for instance, they'd list their property. He'd say, I have 10 camels, 4 sheep, 3 women. This is how he would say. Women were not considered human beings at that time. And in just 23 years, even they would bury their daughters alive. You've heard this, of course. It was said that when a father would give birth to a daughter, he would become so embarrassed. He would hit himself. He would scratch his face. He would run to the desert, and he wouldn't show his face for days. He would feel so ashamed that he would hide from the society until he buries his daughter alive and then returns back. And when he returns back, he says, yes, this terrible thing happened to me. I had a daughter, but I buried her, I killed her, and now I'm over it. That's how bad it is. I mean, it was a terrible situation for women. Imagine such a society. And then the Prophet came. In only 23 years, he put women in the place that they should be in. In such a short period of time. You see all of these people, these feminists, these women's rights activists, they should take our Prophet as their role model. They should say that, you know, look at how women were treated, and then in just 23 years, what happened? Women were put on a pedestal. Women were given rights. Women were considered, you know, important in just a short period of time. These people, should they should They should have a Muhammad day. Really? They should, what's it called? They should be praising him right and left all day long. And they should write books about him, everything. Why don't they? What is the reason why they don't? There's two reasons. One of them is our fault, and one of them is not our fault. The one that's not our fault, which is still partly our fault, is negative media that's, what's it called, that's attacking Islam, right? Sometimes it stems from the hands of Muslims, and sometimes it's their own agenda. Now, for instance, in Sydney, I was reading something in the paper the other day on the internet, and it said there's some woman who was wearing the niqab. She got a parking, like a traffic ticket or something. She started yelling at the police. I don't know what happened exactly. But she made a whole scene and, what's it called, and caused all kinds of problems. And then found out that she was lying about everything she was saying. It made Muslims look bad. If you see, there's other, like, for instance, the Taliban, which, again, the Taliban, they're completely, you know, we completely separate ourselves from these people. And one of the things they do that it's famous for, they don't allow women to go to school, to go to grammar school. They don't allow women to learn to read and write. And there's actually books written by Western people. There's a book called Three Cups of Tea. I don't know if you've seen that book. It's an interesting book. But where people, they've gone to Afghanistan, and they try to fight this. They try to bring schools to the women, to the girls, because they don't have anywhere to go. And this is something that the West attacks us on. Another one is, for instance, Saudi Arabia, the driving issue, where women aren't allowed to drive, and there's all kinds of protests going on right now about that. These are things that the West attacks us. But there's things that we do as Muslim men. There's things that our culture, as the cultures of Islamic countries, that we do that is wrong. There's things that we do that put women down. Now, in Islam, women have rights. They have many rights, and these rights have to be, what's it called? They have to be given to them. We have to protect their rights. Their rights are important. We can't oppress them. We can't take their rights away from them. For instance, working, right? If a woman works, first of all, a husband cannot force her woman to work, cannot force her wife, his wife, to work. A husband can't do that. But if she does work, the money she makes is her money, not your money. The money that she makes from her job is hers. She could buy shoes, she could buy purses, she could buy makeup, she could buy whatever she wants. And you cannot use it for your rent, you cannot use it for food, you cannot use it for clothes, even for her clothes. Because this is wajib upon you to provide. It's wajib upon the man to provide. Unless she, out of her grace, she gives you some of the money to help you out. But she does not have to. It's all her money. Whatever she wants to do with it. Cleaning, cooking, taking care of the kids, nursing the kids. All of this is the responsibility of the man, not the woman. Every single one of them. You should not have any expectations of your wife. If your wife... You come home from work, you work a long day, a hard day, you have a physical, you know, your job's physical labor, you're tired, you come home, your wife hasn't made food. It's your responsibility. Your wife didn't clean the house. That's your responsibility. The kids, your wife doesn't want to take care of the kids. That's your responsibility. Maybe you don't want to hear this, but that's the case. Now, of course, a woman, if she does this, if the woman decides to cook dinner, if the woman decides to clean the house, if the woman decides to take care of the children, decides to nurse the children, she gets rewards. Allah will reward her immensely for these efforts. But the man should not expect it. A lot of times we expect these things from our wives, and it causes problems. It causes problems. But these are her rights that we can't infringe upon. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now the last issue I wanted to touch upon is power. In the age of ignorance, power was given an intrinsic value. It was considered something special. It was considered something noteworthy. People would try to obtain power by any means necessary. They would lie, they would cheat, they would kill, they would oppress, they would do whatever they can to obtain power. Why? Because power was considered in and of itself good, in and of itself positive. It was considered something that we should have, something that we should strive for. It was a goal. It was an objective. But Islam came and said, no. Power in and of itself is nothing. Power, just to have power, power qua power, as they say. It's not important. It's not something that's special. It's not something that it's not a goal. It's not an objective. Rather, it's a means. It's a tool for one to be able to get closer to Allah. If we have power, for instance, in the masjid, some people might be directors, some people might be on the board, some people might be speakers. People have a certain amount of power. In your workplace, there's a manager, there's a boss, there's whatever. There's people that are in a position of power. This power doesn't mean that you're good if you have this power. It doesn't mean that you've reached your goal if you have this power. All it means is if you have more power, you have more responsibility. If you're a director of the masjid, now you have more responsibility. If you're on the board, now you have more responsibility. If you're in a position of power, your responsibility grows because this power is a means to both get you closer to God and to get those who are under you closer to Allah. So this is something that Islam completely changed, where power was not seen as the objective anymore, it was seen as a means. And there's a hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam where he addresses Ash'ath ibn Qais, who was the ruler of Azerbaijan in his time. And he said, your position is not a source of sustenance. He was the ruler of Azerbaijan. Imam Ali is saying this position that you have, it's not the objective. It's not a source of wealth. It's not a source of sustenance. Rather, it is a trust that's been placed upon your shoulders. So you've been given this power. Why? As a trust. As a trust for you to use to get closer to Allah, for you to use to help the people who are under you, the people of Azerbaijan, get closer to Allah. You see, on the one side there's this, then on the other side we see that shortly after the death of the Prophet, after the death of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we see that this immediately changed, and power became again the objective and the goal. We see Muawiyah, he went to Kufa after Imam Ali was martyred. And he went to the Kufans, he went into the Masjid of Kufa, he addressed the Kufans, he had everyone there. And he said, I have not come to lead you in prayer or fasting, to invite you for prayer and fasting. It's not my objective, not my mission. Religion, completely separate. I've come to rule over you. I've come to make you my subjects. I've come to place you under my authority so I could take whatever I want from you. And you see, just in this short period of time, the power reverted back to how it was in the age of ignorance. So today, what should we do? Today, if we're in a position of power, if we have some kind of leeway over anything, we should try to figure out how we could use it to serve Islam. How we could use it to help us get closer to Allah. How we could use it to help us progress on the path trying to reach this proximity with the divine, inshallah. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, we went over a few different subjects today. We went over women's rights, over this power, racism, human value. Inshallah, you were able to, inshallah, it opened your minds a little bit, and inshallah, it'll make you think a little bit about these issues and try to think of how we could try to improve the community we're in, how we could try to revive the things that the Prophet came to teach us. Because this Eid al-Mab'ath, why is it important? Why is it an historical event? Because it's the day that the Prophet came to give us the perfect program of human life. He came to give us the path, to show us the path. And if we've fallen off the path, inshallah, by the right of this day, we could think of ways to get back on this path. Think of ways to get on the path and move forward. Inshallah, on a day-by-day basis, we have to move forward, inshallah. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.